Welcome to Changemakers, a podcast from APH. We're talking to people from around the world who are creating positive change in the lives of people who are blind or visually impaired. Here's your host.
Welcome back to Changemakers. My name is Sarah, and today is bittersweet. After 34 years at APH, Gary Mudd, Vice President, Government and Community Affairs, is retiring. Gary spent much of his time in Washington meeting with politicians and representatives from the Department of Education and showing them why APH and the products and services we offer are so important. In this episode of Changemakers, Gary's longtime colleague, APH Museum Director Mike Hudson, sits down with Gary to talk and reflect about his childhood, his work at APH, his hopes for APH, and what he's looking forward to in retirement. After that, I'll talk to Mike about his thoughts on Gary's impact.
So, Gary, why don't you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and where you went to school?
Oh my, okay. I grew up on a farm in central Kentucky, small, very small burg called Frederickstown on the Nelson and Washington County line. I went to school early on at the little parochial school in that town, burg. And then whenever I went blind at age 12, finally, started out in 11, had several operations, and then was totally blind at 12. I came to the Kentucky School for the Blind and graduated high school from there. Then I went to the University of Louisville and the University of Kentucky.
So you get out of college. Where else have you worked at prior to coming to APH?
Are you talking about all my jobs?
All your jobs prior to coming to APH.
I started working at age 16 at the Industries for the Blind. At that time, it was called that, Kentucky Industries for the Blind. I put together whiskey decanter tops. Back in the day, I don't even know whether they do this anymore or not. The bourbon manufacturers would have decanters that would be specially designed for holidays or whatever. And they had a top that I would assemble the cork and the washers. That was piecemeal work. I got paid by the gross. And then I spent a whole day selling light bulbs by phone. That was a short-lived career, thank God. And I knew that I didn't want to do that the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And then I went back to the Kentucky Industries for a brief time to do some more of that, the bottle wash, bottle decanters. And then I got a job in between my junior and senior year of college at WHAS and WAMZ radio, producing commercials and assistant music director for WHAS, because at the time they played music. This was in 1979, 80, in that time frame. And I worked for them for 4 years. And then that was about the time that the Binghams, who owned the stations, who owned the newspaper in town, the Courier Journal, they sold their businesses. And I always kid, but it's true, I think. I was part of that sale. I was laid off after that. And then I went back to school, finished my degree, looked for a job for 2 years constantly. And then I came to APH in 1986.
So how did you end up at APH? Who interviewed you and what job did you apply for?
I again, I'm kidding, but I'm serious as well. I think I aggravated Carson Nolan into a position here. Carson was the president at that time. And I had met him probably 10 years before this on an airplane by accident. I was going to get my first guide dog when I was in college. And he was going to a conference in New York City. We sat beside one another, whether that was accidental or on purpose.
Uh-huh.
And I introduced myself, talked to him for the whole flight. And then 10 years later, I came to him requesting to be considered for a position at APH. And it took about probably 6 months of us going back and forth. And he finally said yes and hired me. And that's when it started, in October of 1986.
What was your first day like, Gary?
Oh, my. It's been too long to remember my first day. But, yeah, I think I do remember. Scott Blome was my immediate supervisor. He was in doing marketing and communications at the time.
And Scott hadn't been there but a few years himself at that point.
Scott had only been there 1 year.
Yeah.
And so I was assistant marketing for Scott and for Ralph McCracken. Most of what I did at first was communicate with ex officio trustees. That was what I was responsible for doing. And calling them, talking to them, emailing them. However, I could communicate with them.
Were you educating them or was it more getting them to use their quota?
I'm mostly talking to them about quota. And
yeah.
Even back then, there were many new ex officios who were just learning about what federal quota was all about.
Right. So you're constantly educating a new crop of young people.
Yes.
Yeah.
And being friends with the old ones.
You were the first vice president at APH who is blind or visually impaired.
I think that's true, I guess.
And I believe that you are the most senior member of the APH staff who's blind or visually impaired, I mean, historically.
Yes.
So how did that come about? How did you go from this guy that Carson basically fotched off on Ralph to being the vice president?
Well, I guess lots of experience. I was open to change and growing in whatever direction I needed to. And this opportunity, I guess, let me start at the beginning of the biggest change, I suppose. In the early 90s, there was an effort, I should say. We had a congressman in Western Kentucky, and I won't say his name, who knew very little about us, but he was on the Labor, Health, and Human Services and Education Subcommittee. And he had notified us that we would likely look at a 40% reduction in our appropriation if we didn't hire more blind and visually impaired people.
Now, was that under pressure from consumer groups? Was he being pressured?
Yes.
He was.
Yes, it was. And so I had been to Washington several times with Tuck Tinsley, who was the president after 1989, to present to the Labor, Health, and Human Services and Education Subcommittee on the House side. And whenever we were notified of this possible reduction, we knew that it was probably time for us to be more active advocates in Washington. Up until then, we would generally go only when invited. So that early 90s, I'm thinking 1992, 1993, we began that effort to advocate in Washington without being invited, just making appointments.
What was that first visit like for you, Gary? And was Tuck with you?
No, that was another story, I guess. Whenever we decided that we would become advocates, I called Scott Marshall, who worked for AFB. He was an attorney for AFB, the American Foundation for the Blind. At that time, he was their lobbyist / advocate policy person. Scott was a graduate of Harvard Law School. I called him and said, this is the situation. And he said, come to Washington. I'll spend a week with you, take you around, introduce you to people, and teach you how to be an advocate. And then he also said, by the way, you should come by yourself. That was difficult for me to go tell Tuck Tinsley that I would be going to Washington by myself. But Tuck agreed to that. He was very willing for that to begin, and that's how it came about.
I know at one point you had the title of Director of Public Affairs. Was mm-hmm. that about that time that came into being?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then the Vice President position came around 2002.
So what, do you remember whose office you went to, the very first, you know, congressman or senator that you went to first?
I think, I'm pretty sure that it was Senator McConnell.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Did you meet directly with Senator McConnell?
Yes. Early on. And, but then I focused mostly on the subcommittee members.
Right.
And I would always go to our own Kentucky delegation.
So what were the challenges for you were using a dog guide. Was that Heathcliff?
Yes, I was. It was Heathcliff.
Yeah.
I was scared. I grew to appreciate people in Washington. Up until that point, I had little contact with politics, policy, with people in D.C. And I was pretty skeptical of the whole political scene at the time. I grew to respect and the members up there. I really do. I think most are there for the right reasons. And the staff people who work for the senators and representatives are very serious policy people.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned to respect all that as I became more involved with people in D.C. But I was scared at first. I really was. But I also realize now that they're no different than we are.
Right.
They try to make the best decisions with the best information they can get. And that's what we tried to get.
Did you ever get lost in any of those office buildings?
Oh, yes. Got lost lots of times. you know, I spent probably the first few times mostly being lost because in order to get around successfully, you've got to know good directions, and I had to learn some of those directions. That's how I met, people that I had not met but had grown up, like Ted Kennedy. First time I met him was when I was crossing the street in front of the Supreme Court going to the Senate building, and I guess this is happens a lot. Yes, whenever you're blind, visually impaired, when you have a cane or a dog, people assume that you're not sure where you're going. Well, I was pretty sure that day, but he put his arm around me and said, where are you going? And I said, to the Russell Building. And he said, well, I'm going there too. So anyway, he offered to be my guide, and that's kind of how I first met him. Wasn't the only time I met him, but it was the
right.
first time.
But you didn't even really need a guide.
I didn't at the time, but
there were plenty of times that you did.
There were.
So what year was that first visit that you took
to DC? The first visit alone?
Yeah, alone.
I think it was 1993.
And when was the last time that you physically went to Washington?
In February, right before COVID.
So February of 2020. So for 27 years, you've been traveling to Washington on behalf of the American Printing House for the Blind. What was your goal in meeting with congressmen and representatives and senators?
To help them understand why we existed and how we used the funds, the appropriation that we get each year.
Did the job change? In terms of your work in Washington, did it change over those 27 years?
Not drastically. We would make minor changes. Basically, I started out with just asking for a 15-minute meeting. That in those days was pretty easy to come by. And then I would spend the 15 minutes talking about what I was just mentioned, that how we came about as an organization, what we were doing, and how the education of a blind or visually impaired person should look, because we make the products. And as it went on, we probably changed to incorporate more products into the discussion, because I would just get an appointment. We'd take a product. I would give them information about who we are, what we do, and talk about the products that we make, show a product, demonstrate it. And they would begin to open up and ask questions, because most of the people that we talked to had no idea about educating with products. And so they were pretty eager to learn. Most of them were. They would ask questions.
During this time, you know, this whole last 27 years that you've been, you know, making the, you know, of course you go several times a year. You've been going several times a year.
Yeah, usually 6 to 8 times a week or a year, and spend a week each time.
And that's incredible, Gary, really. 6 to 8 times a year to Washington. That's pretty, I mean, that's an ambitious schedule. And of course, the federal appropriation through the act has grown dramatically during that time. And also there's even been other initiatives out of the House and the Senate that have raised our funding even more, but technology and this kind of thing. How would you assess your own impact on that funding increase? You think your visits made a difference?
I think they understood more about educating blind and visually impaired students than they ever know. Yeah. But what's the impact? I have no idea. You can measure it however you want to measure it. But yes, they do know more about us than they used to.
What stands out when you look back over your career at APH? What are you proudest of?
Well, I have to think about that a little bit, because there are several things I'm proud of. I'm proud of the work that we did in Washington. I was around whenever the museum started and the Hall of Fame, and our work with prison braille programs. I was around when Insights started. So all of those things I'm proud of, because they've grown and developed and become part of APH.
You had great relationships with the other members of the EC, the executive committee. Bob Brasher was a good friend of yours. What stands out in terms of memorable moments of your work on the EC?
Well, that would be one. Bob Brasher, Nancy Lacewell, and myself started the Kentucky Prison Braille Program at the Kentucky Institution for Women in Piwee Valley. I lived near there. I happened to know the warden at the KCIW because I had worked with her husband at WHAS radio. And Bob and I used to ride by on our tandem bike many times. And we talk about, wouldn't it be nice to start a program? And so the three of us worked on that and started the Prison Braille program in 2000. And then we started the Prison Braille Network, which was a network of all the prisons throughout the country who had or were interested in starting a Prison Braille program. Because we found out that by nature, prisons are pretty isolated, and the program in Indiana didn't necessarily know much about the program in California. So the network reached out and organized that. So we reached out to the different Prison Braille programs around the country, pulled them together, and have had a forum adjacent to our annual meeting each year since then. This year, of course, it was virtual.
And has Prison Braille and the Prison Braille program's contribution to transcription for textbooks, is that significant?
Yes.
For APH?
Yes, it has. Because quick history here, in the 1950s through the 1950s and much of the 60s, most students who were blind or visually impaired went to residential schools. And APH had a publications committee made up of ex officio trustees who would come in and recommend book titles, book series for us to produce each year. That worked pretty well through the 60s and then began to change when the laws changed. Students began to go to their neighborhood schools, to where now 90% go to their local school districts. And as a consequence, or as a result of that, there are many more book titles needed today. Back in the 50s and 60s, we would make a few titles, book series, and make many copies of that book, and they would be distributed throughout the country to the different residential schools. Today, it's just the opposite. There are many more titles than we could ever produce. So the Prison Braille programs around the country have grown and taking on much of that Braille production responsibilities. So we work with them, and we also do our own. So together, hopefully, we cover most of the Braille needs from textbook standpoint throughout the country.
What made you decide that now was the time to retire?
Well, I'm 68. That was one role or one part of the decision. I think the major thing probably is that whenever we had to go virtual because of COVID, that I did not feel that I could be effective with a computer screen and a virtual meeting, because my the way I operated in Washington was sitting across the table or beside a member in DC. I would put a product in their hand. I would talk about Braille. I would talk about the product and education, and it became a conversation. I don't think I could be effective in a virtual presentation, and that played a big role in my decision to retire.
So another casualty of COVID-19.
Yeah, I guess you could say that, Mike.
So obviously, I mean, you deserve, I mean, it's, you're worthy of so much. Congratulations.
And
yeah, it's, you know, everybody looks forward to retirement. What are you looking forward to in retirement?
Oh my, lots of things. You know, I love to exercise. I love to read. I tandem bike ride still since I was 16. I would like to go. My wife has been a member of a book club for about 20, 25 years. I've always been a little envious of that, and I mm-hmm. would like to read a lot more. Most of my reading has been for my profession or APH, and I would like to start reading some of the, I like fiction, nonfiction, historical fiction. Not a big sci-fi fan, although I would probably try to read some. But that, you know, those, and travel some. Hopefully someday. I've traveled a lot with APH and seen many of the things I would like to see, but I'd like to travel with my wife and kids and grandkids and do more of that together.
What are you going to miss the most about APH?
People. Yeah, the people. This company is in a lot of ways, I've grown up and it's been a part of my family. And I think that working together makes it so. I've been here going on 35 years now, and the people I have worked with and hired, and you work alongside people on things that are important, and you learn to love the people you work with. So it's the people always.
What are you leaving undone? What work is there out there that still needs to be done?
Oh my, well, for sure. Advocacy in Washington, because people are always changing there. Personalities, the people who roll onto the committee and roll off the committee, the Labor, Health, and Human Services and Education subcommittees. So it's not a revolving door, because a lot of people stay there for a good while, but always there are new people to talk with. And talk about policy in Washington. So that's one of the things I think is still undone. Braille is important to me. I had to learn Braille when I was 12. All of my textbooks at that time came from the American Printing House for the Blind. We get questions always about, is Braille relevant today? And I even got that question in Washington quite a bit. And I kid when I say it, but I'm mostly serious that I think Braille will go away just a little while after print does. And then it gives me a chance to explain, because people who are blind or visually impaired use every means they can to gain information. I use a computer with speech, a screen reader. I use Braille to read. I use audio books. And I believe most people who are blind or visually impaired use all of those methods for learning and information, recreation, whatever, any means you can work with. And I think Braille is relevant, and I hope it stays relevant, because it is literacy for a Braille reader anyway, a blind person. Because if you don't know how to, well, you learn much more quickly with Braille when it comes to spelling, sentence structure, paragraph structure, just literacy. And math, of course, is hugely important whenever you can put your fingers on formulas and mathematical equations, things like that. And tactile graphics. Tactile graphics are hugely important. And one of the things, well, tactile graphics and Braille just go together. So those things are still left undone. I think even though more people know about it today, we need to reinforce that every chance we get. So
if I gathered together all the new TVIs that are out there in the schools, just about ready to graduate, if I could get them into a room with you sitting in the middle, what would you tell them?
My goodness. Well, their work is important. I love people who have chosen this career, because it's not easy. It's not easy to be a teacher. It's not easy to be a teacher of the visually impaired, an O&M instructor. It's not easy to keep up with the changes that are going on in the education of a blind and visually impaired student. Their work is hugely important, because we all need to be advocates for what we do. And I think TVIs, O&Ms, ex officio trustees are the best advocates we can find. And it's important. It's important work, because it has such an impact on a student. Because, you know, I mention this to people all the time in Washington, that as much as 80 to 90% of learning has some visual component. And when you don't have that, it becomes even more important to learn in different ways. And that's what we have to do. And those teachers and ex officios and administrators are a very important piece of that education.
Let's go back. And put you in a time machine, and you get to walk in on your first day and sit down and talk to yourself. What do you tell yourself?
Wow.
What would you tell that young Gary Mudd?
Mm-hmm. Not too different than I would tell anybody. You've got to be flexible. You've got to be prepared to take advantage of opportunities. I had no idea whenever I came here what I would be doing, or whether I would even be here that long, because there are just so many jobs out there anymore. It's very unusual for someone to stay in one place for as long as I've stayed here. But I think part of it is because I have been flexible. I have been eager to take on different things. The advocacy in Washington, I would never have known that at the beginning. So be flexible, take advantage of opportunities, and that's the two biggest things I would say to myself.
You think he would have listened?
I probably not. But I'm glad I had the opportunities I've had. that's for sure.
Yeah. So what do you think you've learned from being a vice president?
All right.
Because that's a totally different role, right? I mean, it's, you know, it's one thing when you're going to Washington all by yourself, but this whole vice president thing, you've had to supervise people and plan and so on.
I think the biggest thing that I've learned being a vice president is to hire good people, listen to them, and get out of the way. And hopefully you've hired experts who know more about the topic than I do. And I try to listen to them and clear the path for anything they think is worthwhile working on. That's been part of what I've learned as vice president. And to have a bigger microphone to speak to the things I think are important. So those are the things I think I've learned from being the vice president.
Thank you so much for your time, Gary.
Thanks, Gary.
And we appreciate it. We'll talk to you later.
All right, Sarah. Thank you, Mike.
Now Mike's back to tell me about his experience working with Gary. Gary was a bit shy in talking about himself, so Mike, who has worked at APH for 15 years, is here to tell us just how big of an impact Gary has made on APH. What's it like working with Gary?
Gary is, as he mentioned in his interview, Gary hires good people and then gets out of their way. And so he is the perfect boss. He doesn't suffer fools very lightly. So, you know, but as long as you do good work and you make sure that he knows everything that he needs to know in dealing with other leaders here at APH, Gary is the perfect boss. I love working with Gary, love working for Gary. I'm going to miss Gary greatly.
What is your favorite story with Gary?
Well, Gary is a funny guy in a lot of ways. He is so passionate about education and rehabilitation for people that are blind or visually impaired. And I've learned everything I know about blindness working at Gary's side. He's just a wonderful teacher. He's very passionate, but he has also got this skill that I have often lacked. Gary knows how to play the game. He knows when to push buttons and when not to push buttons. He knows when to fight and when not to fight. And so many, many times, and he'll laugh about this too, if you were to ask him, I will come into his office all tore up about some minor conflict that I've had somewhere in the bureaucracy here at APH and ready to just, you know, burn the place to the ground. And Gary will talk me down off of that ledge. He will give me constructive criticism, give me great advice. And I mean, that has just been replicated a million times that Gary knows when to fight and when not to fight to get the things that he needs done. And he is a passionate advocate. And so he knows when it's time to go to the mat and when sometimes you just have to take your lumps and get along to get along. And I think that's the thing about him that I find most admirable. He knows how to both be a passionate defender of the things that he cares about, but also not to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
What are you going to miss most about working alongside Gary?
Well, Gary has just an amazing, confident, and yet humble leader. He does not take himself too seriously. He loves to laugh. The two of us, when we have our meetings every week, spend half of the meeting laughing. He recognizes the absurdity of the world. I'm going to miss him terribly. He's just a friend, as well as a coworker and as and my boss, and he's the best. And everybody who's ever worked with him will tell you the same.
What do you wish for him in retirement?
I think he's going to be a terrible retiree. Gary is a worker. He doesn't miss work. Work misses him. And I mean, I can't count the number of days where, you know, he doesn't call in sick. You know, the guy fought through, he's a cancer survivor. I think on day one and a half of his retirement, he's going to regret it. And he's going to wonder what's going on over here. And he's going to get involved in something, doing good work for some other nonprofit. You watch. It won't take him long before he's volunteering somewhere. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of places out there that need somebody like Gary, as their spokesperson. And, you watch, it'll happen. He'll be a terrible retiree. He'll be driving his wife crazy. You next thing you know, the whole place will be, he'll have everything organized, and Susan will be so tired of Gary trying to supervise him that, she will probably be hustling him back to APH. He'll be over here begging for a job again. You watch. Maybe at the end of the first week, into the second week. That's what will happen. That's my prediction. Okay.
Is there anything else you want to say about Gary?
Yes, one thing. Gary underplays how significant his work in Washington has been. If you just look at the federal appropriation between 93, when he made his first visit, and 2020, it has grown dramatically. And has grown dramatically because Gary went into those offices just as he described and sat down and looked eye to eye with our nation's highest leaders and convinced them that the work that we were doing here in Louisville was important and that we were partners with them. And he always did it in such a humble and yet confident way. He's just an attractive person. And he was the perfect person for APH to hire as their public spokesperson, the right guy at the right time. And I don't envy the task of whoever is hired to replace Gary to come in and do the job that Gary has done, because he has set an incredibly high bar and has made a true difference in the lives of children and adults who are blind or visually impaired here in the United States. And he will be the last person to toot his own horn, but without Gary, it's hard to say that APH would be in as solid a financial situation as it finds itself today.
He is truly one in a million. We're going to miss him greatly.
We are.
We are happy for him to go to retire, but we want to be selfish and don't want him to leave. But
that's right. If I could nail his foot to the ground in a closet, I would.
As we are going to miss Gary, but we do. We wish him all the best in retirement and plenty of travels and reading and hopefully not driving his wife crazy.
That's right. That's right. Good luck, right. Susan.
This podcast is called Changemakers, and Gary Mudd is just that. From sitting down in front of lawmakers to creating a program for incarcerated individuals to give back through transcribing Braille, to Braille Tales, a book program partnership with Dolly Parton's Imagination Library, Gary is the epitome of a changemaker, and we wish him the absolute best in retirement. That's it for today's episode of Changemakers. Be sure to look for ways you can be a changemaker this week.